On this week's podcast, I had the pleasure of talking to Jay Feldman, and we talked about all kinds of stuff. This is a technical podcast. We talk about polyunsaturated fatty acids at the level of mitochondria. We talk about gut health, starches, carbohydrates, how it's all linked, and how we should really be thinking about health from an energy perspective. And I love this framing. This is essentially Ray Peet's framing. Jay has done a great job of making many of Ray's complex ideas digestible for all of us. And I think you're going to learn a ton in this podcast. We're going to talk about fructose. We're going to talk about carbohydrates, fear-mongering, and really how to live your best life in a way that aligns our nutrition and lifestyle with what our body really wants. As you, many of you know, I'm not a fan of fasting. I'm not a fan of keto. And this is why this energy perspective has really had an impact on the way that I think about things. We don't want to be giving our body the signal of scarcity. We want to be giving our body a signal of abundance by giving it nutrients and organs like liver, either fresh or what we make at hardened soil. And we want to be giving our bodies enough carbohydrates. Obviously, there's caveats based on your individual physiology, but the source of the carbohydrates matter. For many people, including more carbohydrates in their diet is a huge improvement in their thyroid function, their energy, their libido, their endurance. It's a massive upgrade. It's not at the expense of meat and organs. It's in connection with them. And what you find is just the calories in, calories out is bunk. The quality of the calories you put in determines your calories out. So for many people, eating more, not less, results in weight loss, better libido, endurance, muscle gain, and a fuller life. So this idea that you need to do less calories, less meat to live better is, in my opinion, bunk and is the complete wrong way to go. But if you know how to add more and what specific things to add as more, you will truly thrive and you will not be sorry that you listened to this one. Enjoy this podcast with Jay Feldman. Jay Feldman, thank you for coming on the podcast, my friend. It's good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Paul.
So we are going to cover like a lot of stuff in this podcast. It'll be interesting and I think it'll be super educational for a lot of people. It's going to be technical, but we'll try and break it down for people as we go. Now, I want to start with like an energy framework, which is kind of a new way for me to think about things, but I think it's very revealing. But before we get into that, I think that from the outset, let's talk about your background. Like what kind of training do you have? Because you talk about this so well on your podcast, but are you just really self-taught? This is incredible.
Yeah, mostly. I've got a couple of undergrad degrees in neuroscience and exercise physiology. And everything after that has been self-taught. I spent quite a few years digging deep in the research during college, but also after. And yeah, mostly self-taught in that way.
It's interesting. I think it's just a testament. I think that degrees are great, but they don't really mean anything. It's just like, I mean, honestly, I don't know if my audience knows this, but like most of what I talk about on the podcast are things that I've learned on my own too. I mean, podcasting, talking to people, reading books, like I'm essentially self-taught too. I have an MD, but less than a tenth of a percent of what I talk about is anything that I learned in medical school. A little bit of biochemistry, perhaps. I mostly forgot it and then had to relearn it. So I think in some way, we're all really self-taught when it comes to connecting the dots with regard to nutrition and stuff. So that's really impressive. And I think people will appreciate that as we go on in the episode. But so let's just frame it like an energy model. And I know this is kind of like Ray Peet's idea, but you talk about it in a unique way. Like the idea that like chronic illness is an energy production problem. Elaborate on this for us and help the listeners understand like what we're talking about here, because it helps everything make sense that we're going to talk about next.
Definitely. Yeah, it's a really helpful lens and framework called the bioenergetic view of health. And so what we're talking about here is that the energy that we're producing on the cellular level in the mitochondria, that being the primary thing that determines our health, essentially, how well every organ system can function, how well we feel, how well we think, how well we digest our food, the effects on our immune system, all of those things. And so this lens, you know, speaking of research, you know, you see this play out in every single chronic disease process. You see it in fatty liver disease and insulin resistance and diabetes. You see it in heart disease. You see it in neurodegenerative diseases where there are breakdowns in energy production in the mitochondria. We'll call this, you know, it's often called mitochondrial dysfunction. And this leads to a lack of ATP or efficiently produced ATP. And essentially, that is the thing that drives the impaired state of health or drives the degenerative state. And the good news is on the opposite end, if we provide large, abundant amounts of energy, we can regenerate and repair and reverse these disease processes.
And this term mitochondrial dysfunction gets thrown around so often. And I think it's true that almost every chronic illness we're looking at is mitochondrial dysfunction. But I've never really heard it. I don't think anyone really knows what that is. It's just a buzzword, right? When I was in medical school, actually, when I was in residency, I gave a talk and I asked like the medical students and other attending physicians, like, what is inflammation? And nobody really knew what inflammation was. And we'll talk about what inflammation is, but like what, from a bioenergetic perspective, what is mitochondrial dysfunction, which is really, you've said it, but like, let's elaborate on that a little more. Like, so people understand like, what the heck is this mitochondrial dysfunction? And then we can start talking about where it comes from.
Totally. Yeah. So there are a handful of processes involved in producing energy, and I'll try to keep the biochemistry simple.
You can do it, man. This podcast, we get technical. Do it. Throw it out.
Yeah, well, I know we'll dig in deep as we go, but just as a starting place, there's a number of different really key points that, you know, are involved in producing energy. If we're talking from glucose, we start with glycolysis. If we're talking with fats, we start with beta oxidation. They both have to head into the Krebs cycle and then to the electron transport chain in order to produce energy. And there's a ton of different enzymes involved in all of those processes. And these enzymes and also, you know, electron transport chain complexes are attuned to various aspects of our environment in a way that will dictate whether or not they're going to produce energy effectively. And so essentially, when we are in an environment that is inundated with non-optimal things, it will impair different parts of the energy production process, which is largely going on in the mitochondria, lead to reactive oxygen species production, and lead to a lack of ATP production, which leads to then stress systems being kicked in to, you know, to help us out. And so I'm sure that as we talk throughout the podcast, we'll be digging into details there of how this happens and what kinds of things will impair our ability to produce energy. But essentially, we've got these really key processes that go from the food coming in and being digested, and now we've got the fuel, the substrate, and then being able to produce energy from it. And there's this assumption that food comes in and that just equals energy, but that's not the case at all. There's a lot going on there and a lot of ways that that can go wrong. And it goes wrong in these degenerative states. It goes wrong in obesity and weight gain, despite the idea that that's excess energy. It's actually a low energy state where the fuel can't be converted to energy. And so it gets diverted to be stored as fat. So this is really the key. And if we can fix our ability to produce energy from the fuel coming in, not only does that help on the weight standpoint, but also the, you know, that's the key to lowering inflammation. It's the key to keeping stress hormones down. It's the key to repair and regeneration as opposed to degeneration and breakdown.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating perspective because I think that what we're really saying here is that when mitochondria work, you can lose weight and feel better eating more. More fuel equals more energy, better thyroid function, better sex hormones, more muscle mass by eating more. Like, which is really the interesting paradox that we find ourselves in. Not even paradoxical, it's contradictory to what the mainstream idea here is, that weight loss is about eating too, or weight, you know, weight gain is that you're eating too much. And I love this different perspective. It's not necessarily that you're eating too much. It's that you can't use what you're eating because there's a problem. And in your podcast, you've made this, I think, very astute distinction between fuel and energy. Like you said, it's not that all food equals calories. You know, you look at a bag of chips and it says it's this many calories. And as you've said in your podcast, a calorie is just a measure of how much energy it takes to like raise a certain amount of water by a temperature. It's just a stupid, it's not even a real thing. It's a fake thing. But like the amount of quote energy that someone gets out of a food can never be represented on the side of a bag, or even, you know, in the USDA, they can look at a steak and say, oh, it has this many calories. That's really not true. Like it assumes that your biochemical machinery works. And if it doesn't, all calories are not created equally. And it's not just about eating too much. It's that you're not actually using it. So I think about a car also. And this is basically what we're saying is, if your engine, and you know, add to this metaphor if you think, or correct it if you want to, like if your engine is not tuned, it doesn't matter, you know, how much gas you put in the car, how hard you hit the accelerator, you're just never going to get the performance out of the car. You have to have the piston cycling and the valves, and you it's all about the engine. and the quality of the engine's mechanical maneuvering once you put gasoline into it. And the gasoline in this case is human fuel, things we eat. And certain fuels are going to be better for that engine. They're going to burn more clean. They're going to make that engine function. So the engine can have problems. The fuel can have problems. The fuel can contribute to engine problems. But basically, it's like if your engine is tip-top shape, then everything is going to be way better. And that's kind of how I think about it. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah. And as you're getting at, if we ignore this engine problem and just try to step on that gas harder or try to reduce the fuel coming in, we're only going to make the situation worse. We're ignoring the key part there. And as you said, we're not talking about some inborn problem with your mitochondria. They're being affected by the type of food that's coming in, by the type of fuel that's coming in, by the state of your gut health, by how much sunlight you're getting, by your stress. So all of these aspects of our environment are going to affect how well that engine's working. And if we fix that, then we fix our health.
Let's start with polyunsaturated fatty acids and seed oils. I want to get to carbohydrates. And for whatever reason, I think probably because I started out podcasting in the carnivore space, there's still a lot of people that listen to my podcast that get triggered when I talk about carbohydrates. We'll get there and we're going to trigger you guys in the most loving way. But let's start with polyunsaturated fatty acids and seed oils. When I was listening to your podcast and looking at a lot of the references, it's really interesting what's out there around the way that polyunsaturated fatty acids accumulate in the mitochondria and break energy production. A lot of it is mechanistic studies in other species, but it's consistent across species. So there is a solid mechanism, because I think that I talk about on this podcast, hopefully not ad nauseum to my audience, but certainly frequently about seed oils. And this 18-carbon omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acid, linoleic acid. And let's talk about how these polyunsaturated fatty acids, and we can even talk about omega-3s also, but we'll start with omega-6s, or at least make the distinction where it's appropriate. How does this affect the mitochondria? Because this is really where the rubber meets the road. And I think this is fascinating, clearly demonstrated mechanisms for how these seed oils are essentially causing an epidemic of chronic illness. They accumulate in our membranes, but what's going on at the level of the mitochondria? How are they so harmful? What do we know? My energy, libido, and endurance are out of this world. Check out this review on Whole Package from Heart and Soil Supplements. Jeremiah says, I noticed a big difference within the first week to 10 days of taking the supplement. My energy, libido, and endurance have continued to thrive. They're out of this world. Initially, I didn't know what to expect and only tried the whole package once I saw the improvements in my workouts. Initially, I didn't know what to expect. But once I saw the improvements in my workouts, I started looking further into bovine testicles and my interest in other heart and soil products grew. Come to find out that reclaiming your manhood, as stated about the whole package, couldn't be more true. After about 6 weeks on it and 2 weeks also taking bone marrow and liver, as well as the histamine and immune product, I started noticing the gray hair on my chest turning brown again. At that point, I turned to a true believer, and I think it was primarily due to the whole package. I am a believer. Whole package is an incredible supplement, guys. It contains desiccated bull testicles. And if you know anything about these, you know that all of our products at Heart and Soil are Informed Sports certified, which means they contain no additives or anything, except Whole Package failed that test because it actually contains bioactive testosterone and other androgens, which are naturally occurring in the testicles. We don't add anything to this. It's just that, go figure, bull testicles contain testosterone and other bioactive hormonal intermediates. So this contains testosterone, it contains blood, and it contains liver. And this is one of our most popular supplements. Look at the reviews on this, guys. They're out of this world. If you're a man and you need more energy, libido, endurance, check out Whole Package from us at Heart and Soil Supplements. Our website is heartandsoil.co. All of our supplements are packaged in glass. I believe plastic is bullshit. I would never put anything in plastic for you guys. We don't need more plastic on the planet. PFAs, whatever, microplastics, endocrine disruptors, don't want any of that touching your supplements. And all of our organs are sourced from New Zealand and Australia. And what's cool about this is that regenerative agriculture in those places, it's the bee's knees. It is the best I've ever seen. I recently got back from New Zealand and Australia and saw some of the farms where we actually source these organs from. They're green grass all the way to the ocean. These cows are so healthy. Do not accept substitutes, because a lot of desiccated organ imitators out there are from Chile and Argentina. This is not nearly the quality of what we have from New Zealand and Australia. Chile and Argentina have a problem with their quote-unquote grass-fed cattle because they're CAFOing them, they're clustering them. This creates problems with heavy metals, this creates lower quality organs, lower nutrient density in the products. So do not accept imitations or substitutions. Find us at heartandsoil.co. Reclaim your birthright to radical health. Whole package is just an amazing thing. Bull testicles are powerful along with liver and blood. Let us know what you think, guys. Back to the podcast.
Yeah. And what you're drawing attention to is something that we aren't often drawing attention to, right? The idea that the seed oils are a problem, that's gained a lot of attention. And it's maybe the simpler mechanisms, right? The eicosanoids that get produced, the inflammatory mediators, the lipid peroxidation, right? They're unstable fats. When we consume them, we then see increased lipid peroxidation anywhere that those fats go. So those things are maybe more obvious, but you're right. One thing that we're not talking about is the direct effects inside the mitochondria. And when we consume more of the polyunsaturated fats, and we can just keep it at omega-6s first, we will incorporate more of them into the structure of our cells, the different, you know, they're referred to as the membranes. And that's not only, you know, that's the plasma membrane of the entire cell, but also inside the mitochondria themselves. And this has a really dramatic effect on our capacity for efficient energy production. And I think this is more so at play than any other mechanism when it comes to the impact of these polyunsaturated fats on our health. So there's a couple of things that happen, but because of the instability of these fats, when they're used as structural components in these membranes as fats, as phospholipids, they are more permeable to various things crossing through the membrane. And this is specifically going to be different ions like sodium and potassium, as well as the hydrogen ion or proton. And so this has a number of effects. For one, I think we'll start at the proton. So the main way that we produce the actual ATP has to do with creating a proton gradient at the electron transport chain inside the mitochondria, at the inner mitochondrial membrane. That proton gradient depends on us being able to essentially pump a lot of protons to one side of this membrane and use the difference in charge as a way to then produce ATP. We use that as energy. When the structure of this membrane has more polyunsaturated fats, it's more permeable to the protons. So instead of maintaining this really strong gradient with all this energy, the protons leak through the membrane. So we're trying to produce all this ATP, but we're not able to create a strong enough gradient to produce as much. And it reduces energy efficiency dramatically, the efficiency of energy production. And there's some really interesting research demonstrating just how much that is that we can get to. So that's one really important area. But then I also mentioned permeability to other ions like sodium and potassium. And the sodium and potassium gradient is also incredibly important to be maintained between the intracellular and extracellular space. And so when we're leaking the sodium and potassium through, we then have to waste a bunch of ATP pumping that back and maintaining that gradient. And these two things together account for a massive shift in the efficiency of energy production when we have more polyunsaturated fats versus less polyunsaturated fats. So, and this is so impactful that there's an entire theory of aging that's based around the saturation of these membranes. And so this is called the membrane pacemaker theory of aging. So as you had mentioned earlier, we've largely been inundated, especially in the mainstream, with what's called the rate of living theory, where the slower we run our engine, the less calories that are coming in, the less energy we produce, the longer we live, because we're just machines and we just wear out over time. And that theory has been shown not at all to be true for a long time now, for decades now. And that's because we're adaptable organisms. And when, you know, we aren't just wearing out, we're able to regenerate and heal. And there's, you know, a bunch of other intricacies there. However, that theory was, aside just being based out of a theory from the Industrial Revolution, was based on the finding that the animals that have a very high metabolic rate for their body size have a very short lifespan. So if we think like rodents, like mice, they have a very high metabolic rate for their body size, but they don't live very long compared to, let's say, us or apes or elephants, right? That have a much lower metabolic rate relative to lifespan. And so they said, okay, well, the higher the metabolic rate, the faster we die, the faster we age. Now, there is then another finding that totally threw a wrench in this, which is that when you look at the same species, if you just look at all the mice or all the rats or all the dogs or all the apes or all the humans, the ones that have the higher metabolic rates live longer, have a longer lifespan and age slower. So this totally threw a wrench in that. And so, you know, these pieces have been put together. And what they found essentially is that these organisms that have the high metabolic rate, they don't have a really efficient metabolic rate. They have a very inefficient capacity for energy production. And this is because they have more unsaturated membranes. They have more polyunsaturated fats in the membranes of their mitochondria, of the plasma membranes. And so they waste so much energy dealing with this, dealing with, you know, restoring the sodium potassium gradient and trying to produce ATP when there's, you know, they can't do it as efficiently, that this is the number one factor, the driver of the lifespan of why a mouse lives only a few years, whereas we live, you know, 70 or 80 or whatever it is. And so this is huge. And part of this is because within each species, there's a range that's kind of a set point, but we can change our the saturation of our membranes based on our diet as well within that set point. So this is absolutely huge. This is a massive, massive effect, this inefficiency of energy production in terms of health, aging, and lifespan. And so I would say this is the top factor when it comes to the polyunsaturated fats and how they're affecting us. And that doesn't even also consider all of the oxidative stress that goes on inside the mitochondria when these fats are incorporated into the membranes, which just makes it that much worse. Because then the mitochondria there are incredibly susceptible to damage, the membrane is incredibly susceptible to damage, and that oxidative stress also impairs respiration and impairs our ability for producing energy. And the last point I'll mention here is that there's complexes and parts of the electron transport chain that involve fats like cardiolipin. And as that gets more unsaturated, it's also more susceptible to damage and it interferes with mitochondrial respiration in addition. So we've got a number of mechanisms here through which the polyunsaturated fats directly reduce the efficiency of ATP production.
Which is really the ultimate arbiter, right? If you can't make ATP, adenosine triphosphate, efficiently, your life sucks. I mean, that is essentially like if you had to make a molecular correlate of health versus disease, it would be healthy people make ATP easily. Unhealthy people can't make ATP. You just cannot run your stuff. You cannot run your brain. You can't run your neurons. You can't run hormone. You can't run anything because you're not making ATP. But ATP is the last step of energy production. And if we rewind it all the way back, it starts with the things you put in your mouth. And I just want to make sure that people understand the pieces of this intellectual journey that we're going on here quickly. You eat seed oils. You eat sunflower, safflower, corn, or canola, or soybean oil. And there are lots of problems with these oils. They're refined, they're bleached, they're deodorized, they're highly oxidized at baseline, but they also contain lots of this linoleic acid. And there are other foods that contain linoleic acid in smaller amounts. Tallow, butter, 1% to 2%. Seed oils, anywhere from 20 to 55, 60% linoleic acid. So massive differences, often orders of magnitude different. An order of magnitude, sometimes two orders of magnitude different. Massive orders of magnitude difference, right? So there's a major difference in the amount of linoleic acid that we're getting from certain foods. Now, we know that this is not debatable, human physiology, we accumulate linoleic acid. We accumulate all polyunsaturated fats. So the more linoleic acid you eat, the more it's stuffed in every cell membrane in your body, whether it's the membrane of your skin, the epidermis, the membrane of your retina, the membrane of your tongue, or the membrane of your liver, or the membrane of your testicles or your ovaries or your neurons. It's in every single cell in your body. And then within that cell, right, because we have a cell membrane, there are these little organelles called mitochondria. And these are probably primordial bacteria, almost certainly primordial bacteria. And this is where the energy happens. So we go down, 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 right? And so the more linoleic acid you eat, the more linoleic acid is in both the outer and the inner mitochondrial membrane. And one of the reasons we think mitochondria are these primordial bacteria is because they have two membranes. Like, we enveloped them. We had a lipid bilayer, you know, and they have a lipid bilayer, and we enveloped them. You know, we phagocytose them. This one big cell eats another cell. And now that has two membranes. And so it's in that, as you said, it's in that inner mitochondrial membrane where all these little pieces of the electron transport chain occur. And the body, as electrons move through that chain at a high level, the electrons that come from the food we eat, whether it's food from fat, whether it's electrons from fat or electrons equivalents from carbohydrates, we'll get to that. They move through the electron transport chain. And as they're doing that, the whole point of doing that is to move protons, right, between those two membranes to create a gradient, essentially a battery. And this evidence that polyunsaturated fats in those membranes makes that battery leaky is so profound. It's like, wait, you're making a battery to run your life, and the linoleic acid makes the battery crappy. It just makes it leak. The polarity of the battery, which is what you need to carry the energy, because at the end of the electron transport chain, those protons move, that gradient you've created moves through this little motor, this microscopic motor called ATPase, and it makes ATP. And if there's not as many protons move through that, you make less ATP. And so this idea that you are leaking, literally leaking proteins, and this has been shown in multiple studies, this proton leak at like a quantum physics level, they can measure this. There's quantum leak of these protons with more linoleic acid in these membranes. That to me is just freaking profound, that you're basically making a really crappy battery. You know, you're just making bad, the engine is bad. Like at this point, the metaphor breaks down and I'm mixing batteries and engines, but you guys get the idea that like, basically if you want to be healthy, you want to make ATP and you're going to make less ATP because you have less of a gradient with the protons because you're leaking the protons. And then you mentioned the cardiolipin. Let's talk about that for a moment because it's something that Chris Kenobi mentioned on my podcast many months ago, but I haven't spoken about it in a while. These occur at like the little cristae, right? The folds in the mitochondrial membrane. So now tell us about cardiolipin and what happens with cardiolipin because they're in the mitochondrial membrane.
Yeah. So in short, cardiolipin improves the efficiency of the electron transport chain. It makes a really big difference in the speed through which everything moves. It helps to conglomerate things in a way that allows for efficient electron transport and proton pumping. And it's a lipid-based compound. That's where the cardiolipin comes from. And so just like the membranes, when we're consuming more unsaturated fats, more polyunsaturated fats, more omega-6s, more linoleic acid, the composition of the cardiolipin shifts and incorporates more of those fatty acids. Now, in the same way that these are incredibly unstable and susceptible to oxidation, if we were to cook with them or fry food with them, or just have them in our bodies at 98 degrees Fahrenheit and with all the oxygen running around and whatnot, this, if we are essentially putting this inside, as you said, a battery where we are the most, if something's going to get damaged, it's there. There's a lot of electrical current. There's a lot of oxygen available. You know, we're trying to produce energy in this factory or in this engine. That's not a place where you want really unstable fats. And so as the composition of cardiolipin shifts, it becomes more susceptible to peroxidation, to damage. And that directly impairs the function at the electron transport chain and impairs energy production, ATP production. And we see this when we consume, or you know, when they test in animals, that it'll shift the cardiolipin composition and lead to more damage there and then lead to impaired ATP production, impaired mitochondrial respiration.
So we're breaking the motors again here. And I think that there is some statistic I've heard, maybe you've heard this, like when we're born, the composition of our cardiolipin is massively different than it is later in our life. That when we're born, the majority of our cardiolipin is saturated and monounsaturated fats, I believe. And then as we go through life, we just accumulate more polyunsaturated fats in our cardiolipin and we get leakier and leakier membranes. We get more and more fragile fences between these two compartments and it just gets to be crappier and crappier. And you can see this. And in fact, you can see this in the breast milk of moms and then in the kids that it changes throughout our lifespan the more linoleic acid we eat.
Yeah. Yeah. And I haven't seen that that statistic or that research, but I'm sure it's the case. And yeah, no, without a doubt, that has something to do with, you know, the average diet.
And then there's some research, and I've seen this before, and then I was reminded of it with your stuff, that in many species, as they go into hibernation, they consume more of these polyunsaturated fats. So let's talk about this for a moment, that across other species, there is some trends toward polyunsaturated fats inducing sluggishness, hibernation, weight gain. Like, okay, this is wild.
Yeah, so biology is really smart. And there are a lot of purposes that we see in nature for the polyunsaturated fats. They don't just exist by accident. There's actually sometimes benefit to inefficient mitochondrial respiration. One would be, as you said, hibernation, where if we want to slow down our metabolic rate so that we can hibernate, we need to have polyunsaturated fats. And so this is why you see increased consumption of things like nuts and seeds in bears or in, you know, squirrels eating acorns, even though they don't fully hibernate, they gain a lot of weight and slow their metabolic rate down. You know, bears also relying on salmon for the omega-3s, which we can come back to, but also very highly unsaturated fat, polyunsaturated fat. And so this is essentially required in order to hibernate. If you take out, if you prevent those omega-6s from participating, you can't get into hibernation, can't get into torpor. So this is incredibly important in situations like that. And if we wanted to hibernate and wanted to slow our metabolic rate and slow down our function, that might be a time where we'd want to consume a few more polyunsaturated fats. And there are, in even taking a step back as far as why the seeds and nuts have high amounts of polyunsaturated fats, it's for the same reason. Seeds are the reproductive part of the plant, and they need to be able to get through a cold winter or cool spring in order to germinate, and they can't die. They need to be able to live throughout that time. And polyunsaturated fats are great for that. This is why you see high levels of polyunsaturated fats relative to where the seeds come from. If you take soy and you bring it to, you know, a high latitude versus a low latitude, you know, closer to the equator, it'll have less polyunsaturated fats if it's closer to the equator. But also the different types of seeds and nuts that grow in these places, you see it very clearly as well, where the tropical coconut and cocoa, you know, for chocolate, cocoa beans, have very saturated fats. Whereas, of course, all of the seed oils that we use are normally not grown in tropical regions, and they have a lot of polyunsaturated fats. So we see this play out in nature. And again, it's great if that's the goal, is to hibernate and lower your metabolic rate and lower your function. But I think that's not what most of us want to do.
No. I mean, some would believe that's what the government wants us to do. Who knows? Subservient, obedient beings, but we won't get too conspiratorial there. It's an interesting pattern that we see across different species. And I don't think we need to go much further with the seed oils. I've talked about this a ton on the podcast, increasing oxidized LDL, accumulating in LDL particles, without question, problems at all different levels with seed oils. I will mention briefly that at the time we're recording this podcast, Sweetgreen, one of the biggest sort of fast, casual salad with meat chains, they actually do have meat, has announced the removal of seed oils from their cooking oils. And they're phasing it out from their dressing. So this is a big deal. And I think that I'll toot the horn a little bit here. I think this was driven in part by the content that I did on them. And it so many people saw, I mean, millions of people saw this content across TikTok and Instagram and YouTube. Literally millions of people saw this content, and their customers let them know they didn't want seed oil. So it's happening. This is exciting, guys. So props to Sweetgreen for doing that. They're looking to phase out in the dressings. I don't think they've phased it out completely. They have some issues with the dressings. They have to refrigerate them, et cetera. But they're using avocado and olive, which are significantly better. I think tallow and butter would be better than avocado and olive, but they're thinking about this. And then also Hopdoddy, which is a grass-fed burger restaurant chain in the U.S., at least in the Western United States, has also announced the removal of all seed oils. They were previously using soybean oil in their fryers. They're now using zero-acre cultured oil in their fryers, and they've gotten rid of it. And they also, in tandem with that, got rid of plant-based burgers, which is freaking amazing. So it's happening. The other side of the argument on seed oils, which I plan to address as best I can, is that there are larger randomized controlled trials of humans that do show that with increasing seed oil consumption, there is no harm, but no benefit. Of increasing seed oils in terms of cardiovascular outcomes. So this is what the other side will levy. And they'll say, look, there are these randomized trials with humans, and they're saying, they're just taking two groups of people and saying, hey, you eat more seed oils, you eat the same amount of seed oils. And they'll say, hey, look, long-term, these people do not have increased cardiovascular disease. But as we've pointed out on Twitter, and as I will continue to discuss, there's no control group in those studies. So in order for something to be a randomized controlled trial, it has to have a control group. So what's important to understand, and Jay, you can comment on this also, is that in 2023, some massive amount of our calories is coming from seed oils. I saw, I think it was on your website, that like over 20% of our adipose tissue is now polyunsaturated fatty acids, whereas 50, 60 years ago, it was less than 7%. So basically, we have clearly succeeded in the last 50 to 80 years in the United States in polyunsaturating our population. And so the other argument here, the counter argument is, hey, you can show me a controlled trial, a quote unquote controlled trial that says, if we increase the seed oils, there are no worse cardiovascular outcomes. But even the people in the control group are so full of seed oils that we don't have a healthy population that doesn't have seed oils. I mean, have you seen these counter arguments on Twitter? And I mean, what is the straw man here? How could anyone argue that seed oils are not harmful for humans?
Yeah, of course. So for one, the lack of control group is a really great point. And another important caveat or piece to that is we really, to see benefits, we need to get polyunsaturated fat consumption really low. We're talking at least single digits. And so if we're taking a trial where we're comparing 15% versus 25% polyunsaturated fats, we're probably not going to see much of a difference there. We're not getting to a point where we would actually be able to parse out any of those differences. So I think the premise also is coming from the standpoint that if there is no human randomized clinical, clinical trial to clearly state that, in every single condition, this is harmful, then we can't say it's harmful. And I don't think that that is the way that I would like to go about determining what's healthy or what's not. I think we need to consider all the data, and those trials are important, don't get me wrong. But so is mechanistic data, and so is data in animals or any organism that we can have much more control over, where we can actually identify the mechanism, we can view an entire lifetime and then unfortunately kill the organism and view all the tissues and see everything that's happened. Those things provide a lot of really important information, and not that you can blame everything on this, but there is huge, huge industry behind the consumption of seed oils. And you can see it there. The Heart Healthy sticker is there, and it's been there for quite a while now. And when you dig into that history, I think it's really telling. There are some labs that are putting out some really great trials and data on this, but there's a lot of reason for that not to be what's in the headlines.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And I think that these discussions are good. I want people to show the contradictory trials. We want to talk about how we parse out at all the data and how we make sense of it. But I think your point is super, super important for people to understand that, and I've talked about this in the past with Chris Kenobi and others, that historically, humans would have had probably less than 2% of their calories from linoleic acid, and we would have had very low single digits. I mean, butter and tallow are less than 2% linoleic acid, less than 2%, especially if they're grass-fed and grass-finished. There really wasn't a whole lot of seed and nut consumption in our ancestors. It's just very rare. It takes a lot to open an almond. Yes, the Khoisan do eat Mongongo nuts, but if you look at the time of year when they're eating Mongongo nuts, there's evidence they're more insulin resistant and that it changes based on their consumption of Mongongo nuts. The Hadza do not eat nuts. They don't eat seeds unless they're absolutely starving. They just don't. And so this idea that we were eating lots of nuts and seeds is pretty false. And I've done content around this. I mean, to get the equivalent of 5 to 7 tablespoons of corn oil or any seed oil, 3 to 5, give or take 2 to 7, is about what the average American consumes. You have to eat pounds of corn. I mean, 60 plus ears of corn, pounds of soybeans, pounds and pounds of sunflower seeds. It's ridiculous. We would never have had the equivalent of these concentrated doses. And so we're looking at studies which have no representation. There's no control group. Everyone is, and this idea, like you say, this is what's critical. In order to see benefit and return to this optimal energetic state, we really have to get these linoleic acid levels pretty low, which is why I really think about for people just knowing every source of linoleic acid in your diet and mitigating that as much as possible. Is that how you think about it too?
Definitely. Yeah. And again, when we're looking at what will change the composition of the membranes of the mitochondria or of other tissues, it requires that really low single digit levels of the polyunsaturated fats. And that's when you're going to start to see the trades. So, where you're starting to trade more monounsaturated and more saturated fat for the poly. So you do need to get it low to see those effects. And again, I think we have the step-by-step situation where we know that these polyunsaturated fats are much more easily oxidized. We consume them and then they take up residence in our tissues. They take residence in the LDL. We know that that increases susceptibility of oxidation for the LDL. We see that oxidized LDL in plaques and arteries, and all of the other byproducts, all the lipid peroxides. Yet we're not allowed to draw that conclusion. Like, there's not enough convincing evidence there. It's like, maybe, but I'm not going to be eating those polyunsaturated fats. You can have them.
One of the guys on my team sent me an article the other day, and it was really pretty wild. I'm going to do a whole YouTube video about it. And it was an article talking about how conventional egg consumption increases the susceptibility of LDL to oxidation. And it's this idea that conventional eggs from chickens fed corn and soy have a decent amount of linoleic acid. So it doesn't really matter where you get it from. And look, an egg is better than a seed oil, but like conventional egg consumption increases the susceptibility of LDL to oxidation. That is wild. And now, to be fair, a wild chicken is going to eat bugs and grubs and not as many high linoleic acid grains. That egg is going to be much lower in linoleic acid. But this is one of the conundrums that I see with eggs, is that eggs are great for humans, but today it's really hard to find a good egg. So it's just, the point is, and this is just looping back to what I was saying just a moment ago, is that I think for us to be healthy, it's important to really understand all the sources of linoleic acid. And for a lot of people, and this is one of the most unpopular things I've ever said, Jay, but I think I've heard you guys echo it on your podcast, is that like even pork fed corn and soy and chicken fat, like these are not necessarily healthy things to make the majority of your diet. Is bacon better than canola oil? Yes. Bacon is better than canola oil. Bacon is better than soybean oil. Yes. It's probably not a great thing to have the majority of your fat coming from lard, which is going to be sometimes 15, 20% linoleic acid, which is getting close to canola oil. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, it's great that there's been such a focus on seed oils, but yeah, let's not forget nuts and seeds themselves, which are really high in the polyunsaturated fats. They're just as high because that's where the oils come from. And let's not forget the chicken and pork, where they're eating those seed oils partially to make them fat. Before they were marketed to us humans as health foods, they were used just to fatten up the livestock until, now they can do both, fatten up the livestock and the human population. But chicken and pork will be just as high in polyunsaturated fat, sometimes 30%+. And as you said, the eggs from the chickens as well. So if we're going to eat chicken and pork, I would only have lean cuts unless you know that it's not fed high PUFA food, unless you know what it's eating, you know that it's not just pastured, but that it's also not being given any high PUFA foods. And there are some really great places that are testing their pork and showing that it's low PUFA. And so if you're going to eat any fatty chicken or pork, I would be making sure it's from those sorts of sources. And if not, I would stick to the lean ones, because that's just as much a source of omega-6s of PUFA as the seed oils.
And it all accumulates. I was recently in Australia. I went to Byron Bay. I want to give a shout out to a butcher there and a farm called Locavore. If you guys are in Byron Bay, go check out Locavore. I went to their farm. They have amazing Highland cattle, but I got to see their pastured pork and it was amazing. Their pork were literally on a green patch of grass, like you would see cows on. They had one patch of grass for cows, which were Highland cattle. And we can put a picture of Highland cattle in the YouTube so people can see. That's an amazing type of cattle. It's the type of cow that's on like the Heart and Soil website front page. It's like this beautiful hairy cow with the big horns. But the pasture next to the Highland cattle is pastured pigs. And they have this little house for the pigs that they live in, but then they move the house every day. So the pigs are rooting around in the grass. They're getting bugs. They're getting worms. And they'll give them table scraps. And they give them sprouted wheat, but that's lower in linoleic acid than corn and soy. And they're sprouting the wheat. And so they are feeding them some grains, but they're thinking about what grains they're feeding them. And they're not just pumping corn and soy into these pigs. And so I did eat that pork, but that was the first pork that I had eaten in years, Jay, years, because of these issues. Let's talk about fish oil for a moment, and then I want to transition to some gut issues. So I think fish oil is overconsumed, but fish oil is also a PUFA. What's going on here?
Yeah, I agree that it's overconsumed. So if we're going to compare omega-3s to omega-6s, there's a couple of key differences. One, omega-3s are typically less stable, more unsaturated with more double bonds, meaning that they're more susceptible to oxidation, not only when they're on the shelf, but also when they're in our tissues. So that's one difference. The other is they produce different eicosanoids, which is the main reason why people have a different view of omega-3s from omega-6s, where the omega-6s are considered to have inflammatory eicosanoids, whereas the omega-3s are considered not to be inflammatory or to be anti-inflammatory. We can come back to that. However, on the basis that the worst part of the omega-6s is the permeability and susceptibility to peroxidation, both again on the shelf, in our digestive systems, in our blood, and in our tissues, the omega-3s are that and worse because they are more susceptible to peroxidation. And so when looking at these studies involved in the membrane pacemaker theory of living, or of aging, which is the what I was mentioning earlier with the different levels of polyunsaturated fats and how that affects lifespan and aging and health. The omega-3s are worse typically because they have more double bonds and they lead to more permeability and more susceptibility to oxidation than the omega-6s. And if we just take fish oil, we see it very clearly there. Most fish oil is already oxidized on the shelf in levels beyond what's supposed to be regulatory standards. When we consume it, there are studies showing that just the digestive system alone will increase peroxidation substantially. And then we can look at studies looking at pharmaceutical grade fish oil in the triglyceride form. We can look at it in cod liver oil. We can look at it with antioxidants, and you still see increased levels of lipid peroxidation and especially worse disease processes when you see this play out over time in animals. You see the lipid peroxidation in humans. And when you look at this in animals and you look at animals that are given higher levels of omega-3s, it shortens their lifespan and it increases lipid peroxidation and it interferes with mitochondrial respiration. So I think the omega-3s are next. They're the next seed oil, or fish oil is the next seed oil. And I think if we're concerned about all those things with omega-6s, we should be that much more concerned with the omega-3s. And that means not only fish oil supplements, but also fatty fish like salmon. There are a couple of varieties that are a bit leaner and aren't going to have quite as much of the omega-3s. But in general, if we're going to eat seafood, I would lean toward much leaner seafood that's going to be very low in omega-3s.
Yeah, this is going to stir some people up, man. I remember Rhonda Patrick, whose work I respect, and I've asked her multiple times to debate and had been met with only silence and no willingness to debate. But she's recommending large doses of fish oil to people. And I think this is something that needs to be discussed for the health of the human population. There's multiple studies with editorials, I think in JAMA, and maybe in one of the Journal of American Cardiology journals, showing clearly increased rates of atrial fibrillation and arrhythmia in humans taking 4 grams of fish oil per day plus. And I just think, yeah, like you said it, I hadn't thought about it that way, but that's pretty interesting. Like, fish oil is the new seed oil, and there's no reason for any of you guys listening to this podcast to be taking fish oil. I just don't think you need it. I think it's harming you for the same reasons: membrane permeability, cardiolipin, everything. I'm sure we could find, I don't know if there's actually a study showing that fish oil, I keep saying it, it's like the same thing. Fish oil increases LDL oxidation, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's actually data on that, maybe not in humans, but certainly in vitro, which would be suspect. And we need to make sure we look at that carefully. But there are omega-3s, just like there's linoleic acid in animal foods. There are omega-3s in animal foods in very small amounts. And I think that's the amount that you need as a human. And you don't need more than that. You don't need to be fish oil is the equivalent of fish seed oils. They're taking fish, they're concentrating it into seed oils, they're concentrating it into fish oil, they're refining it, often they're bleaching it, they are deodorizing it. I mean, like you said, if you look at these oils, the processing of a fish oil is maybe not quite as bad as a seed oil, but it's pretty similar. And a lot of these oils, these fish oils, will give you fish burps, which is a clear sign of rancidity. I remember when I worked in cardiology, there were pharmaceutical grade fish oils. And one of the selling points was, hey, you can bite this capsule. It doesn't taste like rancid fish. And I'm sure that's because they just bleached it or deodorized it. And, you know, a pharmaceutical grade, maybe they have less peroxidized lipids, but certainly when you digest it, you're going to create oxidized lipids. And I shudder to think, Jay, of all the samples, I suppose that's not ethical, but yes, I was eating some fish oil samples from pharmaceutical grade fish oil from the pharmaceutical reps that they would give to us. And I was just pumping that stuff, man. I thought, oh, this is great. It used to be called Loveza and Omicor. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, pharmaceutical grade fish oil, this is great. And I filled myself up with that. Now, the only data that I've seen for polyunsaturated fats in general, whether it's omega-3 and omega-6, is around 4 years for turnover. Have you seen something like that? I mean, it's not the end of the world. And that was more than 4 years ago. So hopefully my membranes are different. But is there hope for anyone listening to this who's, you know, got fish oil in their hand right now and maybe put canola oil on their salad this morning?
Yeah, of course, of course. So in the same way that eating more of those oils will start to increase those, you know, the composition of the fats, increase those as the composition, eating fewer of those and eating more mono and saturated fats will help to shift that composition back. And yeah, the research, of course, is not fully clear on how long that could take if you fully cut them out, and it would depend on all those details. But even if, yeah, maybe it takes 3 to 4 years to fully change the composition of all of your tissues, that can still mean that it's at least half changed or halfway there in a couple of years. And I think most people notice immediate effects, because not only is it, again, of course, the composition in the membranes and the lipids and the tissues, the phospholipids, is extremely important, but the metabolic depressing effects are things that I think people can find relief from pretty quickly as they start to avoid these fats. And yeah, I mean, of course, we want to get there faster. And, you know, we can talk about maybe vitamin E as a way to protect ourselves against that lipid peroxidation, you know, if we're on that journey. But yeah, it'll take some time. And maybe just to highlight that too, you know, one place that that the oxidative stress effects of omega-3s is really clear is at the liver in terms of the effects on LDL. So this is one of the main things that's pointed to as a benefit of omega-3s, is it'll lower your LDL. And for some reason, you know, the mechanism there is not often discussed. And perhaps it's because what happens is there's a certain protein that's involved in the secretion of the, or production of the LDL particle, or the VLDL particle, and that's ApoB. And when we consume more omega-3s, it damages the, it causes an oxidative damage to that ApoB protein, and therefore decreases the amount of VLDL that can be produced at the liver and secreted. So the way through which omega-3s lower LDL is by causing this oxidative stress at the liver. And this is, of course, looked at as a good thing, right? We want to lower that LDL. So yeah, it's, you know, but I guess the reason why I come to that, just coming backward, is because vitamin E helps to protect against those kinds of effects. So there are certain things that we can do, like use a good quality vitamin E supplement to help protect against the years of PUFA consumption.
And also, I want people to know that animal fat contains vitamin E. So I don't think the USDA has figured this out, but butter or tallow, this is vitamin E, you know, like this is a fat soluble vitamin in animal fat. Grass-fed animals, grass-finished animals, regeneratively raised animals are going to have more vitamin E in their fat. So for me, this is one of the single greatest arguments for eating animal fat above things like olive or avocado, because you're getting nutrients in the fat. We never think of nutrients in fat. The vitamin K2 is fat soluble as well. And so certainly if you're eating animal fat, I think that's a food source of bioavailable vitamin E. And whenever I've tested my vitamin E levels, they're high normal. And, you know, it was ironic because back to Rhonda Patrick, you know, when she was on Rogan's podcast many years ago, she said, I don't know where people are getting vitamin E on a carnivore diet. Because if you look at the traditional things, the only places you get vitamin E are from seed oils, right? From almonds. Well, guess what, Rhonda? I measure my vitamin E multiple times. It's higher than probably hers. It's super high because animal fat is a better source of vitamin E than any of the traditional sources of vitamin E like nut oils. I also wanted to say, so this protein in the liver is the PRPP protein, right? And it's affected by both omega-3 and omega-6, isn't it? Because omega-3s and omega-6s both lower LDL, probably through this oxidative mechanism in the liver.
Yeah, so both of them will have that effect. I know that it affects the ApoB, which is being produced from the endoplasmic reticulum. I don't know about the PRPP. Maybe that's a separate mechanism.
Yeah, I think it's the PRPP protein or whatever. But yeah, it's interesting that this is one of the reasons that seed oils lower your LDL. Enter the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association, who recommends that you eat seed oils. Because it lowers your LDL by creating oxidative stress in your liver, which degrades the ApoB. What the heck? Like, seriously, guys? Really?
Yeah, well, and think about what happens if your liver can't export fat. What happens when the liver accumulates fat? That's not a good situation either. So, you know, in talking about the drivers of a fatty liver state, PUFA, the omega-6s and omega-3s, I would say are heavily implicated in causing oxidative stress, causing the accumulation of fat because we can't oxidize it well and we can't oxidize glucose well. And causing the storage of fat as well, which, yeah, definitely not a good idea. And coming back to the vitamin E real briefly, there's quite a few studies showing that when you consume more fish oil, it depletes vitamin E. So if you're, you know, it's true that there's higher levels of vitamin E in nature alongside PUFA to try to help protect it. So if you've consumed PUFA, we might want a bit of extra vitamin E. But if you're not consuming a lot of polyunsaturated fats, you should have high vitamin E levels because you're not wasting it or using it on preventing the peroxidation from the unsaturated fats. So yeah, it makes total sense.
Let's shift gears and talk about the gut a little bit. You have an episode of your podcast. And I think that if anyone is curious, I would recommend listening. just to the first, even just start with like episode number one of Jay's podcast, which is called the Energy Balance Podcast. If you just listen to like episodes 1 through 6, you just get this great little course. And I know on your website, you have like a mini course and I'm sure you have lots of teaching, but just the first 6 episodes are awesome. And so I think the 3rd episode is about gut health and it's really interesting. So let's talk about this. Like high level, let's just try and summarize for people your perspective, which is very similar to mine, on like which foods are good for the gut, which foods are bad for the gut, and why we don't want to create inflammation, endotoxin, aka lipopolysaccharide in the gut, and how that affects us systemically. So we're shifting a little bit, but it's all connected.
Yeah, it'll definitely come back to energy production as we started. So when it comes to gut health, I think that this is one of the key reasons why people have such benefit when they go on the ketogenic diets, when they fast, when they go, you know, full carnivore, they take out all the plant foods, is because of the effects of a lot of those carbohydrates on the digestive system and the fact that a lot of people have very compromised digestive systems and gut health and microbiota. So when it comes to gut health, I mean, there's a number of important things, right? We need to be able to break our food down, which requires adequate stomach acid, adequate bile flow, adequate digestive enzyme production. We need to have good motility so that the food is not sitting in the intestines, allowing bacteria to grow on it and and allowing it to ferment. But then that next piece is that we need to make sure we have a healthy microbiome that is not overgrown, especially with certain harmful species, and that also has not grown up into the small intestine. So our small intestine should be relatively clear of microbes. And this is an issue that affects a ton of people. And so if you're somebody who benefited from cutting out the carbs, cutting out the plant foods, it's very likely that there's underlying digestive issues there. And we see this in a number of studies where you can provide a ton of the benefits of something like a ketogenic diet, even on like seizures, just by transplanting the microbiome to other mice that aren't on the ketogenic diet. So, and then the key part here, you know, the endotoxin that you mentioned is that if we then reintroduce the lipopolysaccharide, the endotoxin, that will cause the issues to come back. And so what this big issue that plagues most people is that on one hand, they either aren't breaking the food down as well, and so there's extra undigested food hitting the bacteria, or their motility is slow, giving the bacteria a lot of time to consume the food that they're consuming, or they are starting off with some sort of imbalance in the microbiome. And so when they're consuming anything that feeds bacteria, there's massive increases in bacterial toxin production. And the most notable of these, the most well-studied and discussed one, is lipopolysaccharide, which is also called LPS or endotoxin. And the effects of endotoxin are hard to understate. You know, when we look at some of the most severe states that someone can be in, like septic shock, endotoxin is the culprit there. In other words, if we have enough endotoxin, it will kill us. And the reason it does this, or the way through which it does this, is essentially as a mitochondrial poison. It directly impairs the function at certain electron chain complexes, particularly complex 1 and complex 4, meaning that this is one of those main things that breaks down the engine, that prevents the battery from functioning well. And it means that the food that's coming in, let's say it's then feeding bacteria, we've got some endotoxin being produced, well, then we're not going to be able to efficiently convert that fuel to energy. So we end up with a lack of energy, and that fuel gets redirected toward the body fat. And so this is huge. And the good news here is that we can fix this issue without just avoiding all carbohydrates and without cutting out all plant foods necessarily. And depending on your state, you might do much better if this is an issue. If you start off with things like honey, maple syrup, or fruit juice, particular types might still be an issue, like apple juice, I'd be careful of, but non-fermentable carbohydrates, because they won't be feeding that bacteria. And so, yeah, this is a massive, massive piece. I would say one of the maybe top 3 things that affect our capacity for energy production in the average person is going to be whether or not we're producing a lot of endotoxin.
So let's go a little deeper here, because I was talking to a good friend of mine about this the other day, and he said, he's a well-known podcaster, and he said, "You're not a fan of fiber, are you, Paul?" And I said, "Well, I've been thinking a lot about fiber, and I think there's some nuance with fiber." And my perspective is increasingly becoming that if we consume the wrong types of fibers that end up in our large intestine and can contribute to overgrowth of bacterial there, it can increase lipopolysaccharide. But not all fiber is harmful for humans. And certainly, so let's talk about this. Like, what kind of foods, from your perspective, from this bioenergetic perspective could potentially feed colonic bacteria, increasing endotoxin, which is something we don't want to do, and what kind of fibrous foods might be fine for that?
So just on a food basis, things like whole grains and raw vegetables are going to be some of the worst offenders, both because of the anti-nutrients that are included there, which have their own inflammatory effects, their own effects on increasing the proliferation of really harmful bacteria that produce endotoxin, their own effects on impairing digestion, impairing starch breakdown, and things like that. So they've got a number of issues, and I would say those are by far the worst offenders when it comes to carbohydrates, is whole grains, whole legumes as well, and raw vegetables. If we process those things well, if we soak and sprout the grains, we can reduce those anti-nutrients, and that can help and make them more tolerable. So I'd say those are generally the worst. When it comes to things like cooked vegetables and fruit that have whole fruit with the fiber, this is where we get into potentially more of a gray area depending on the individual. So if our gut microbiome is healthy, or at least mostly healthy or pretty decent, we can normally do all right consuming some cooked vegetables and whole fruit. And the reason for that is because, yes, there's fiber in there, but there are also polyphenols in there. And the polyphenols have some really interesting effects in the intestines, in that they seem to have selective antimicrobial effects, where they tend to either reduce the growth or kill off the growth of only the more harmful bacteria and support the growth of the beneficial ones and allow the fiber to generally feed those. And I don't think this is just serendipitous. I don't think this is an accident. I think this largely has to do with the fact that something like whole fruit was integral to our progression as humans, and the microbiome that has become healthy for us happens to be compatible with consuming something like whole fruit. And so if somebody has a really bad overgrowth, or just a bad overgrowth, they might have issues with the fibers in fruit. They might have issues with the fibers in cooked vegetables. But if they don't have that, or if they've gotten to a better spot where they've started to reduce that growth, consuming those things, I would say, is really important and helpful for supporting a healthy microbiome. And again, coming back to particular types of fibers that feed different bacteria, as well as the polyphenols.
Yeah, this is really interesting. So I think I was wrong about polyphenols. When I wrote my first book, The Carnivore Code, I was very negative toward polyphenols because there are some polyphenolic compounds that are digestive enzyme inhibitors, and some polyphenolic compounds like soy isoflavones, which appear to be estrogenic. So there's different types of polyphenolic compounds. But this idea that there could be almost this, I don't want to use the word intelligence because then people think of like intelligent design and it gets religious, and that's not what I'm inferring here. But there is this sort of evolutionary consistency where foods that we would have been eating evolutionarily, probably predominantly ripe fruit. I don't think evolutionarily we were eating nearly as many vegetables as people think we were. And if we were eating them, we were cooking the heck out of them and processing them and fermenting them. And there were certain ways that we were aware of different vegetables. Definitely when I was with the Hods, I didn't see them eat a single vegetable. So they did eat roots, but they did not eat leaves. They did not eat seeds. They did not eat stems. They did not eat any of that stuff. And that's what I think of as vegetables, like leaves and stems and seeds, but whatever, especially leaves. And so it's very interesting to me that in fruit, along with the fiber, are polyphenols that might actually be tonic in some way, grooming, quote unquote, the human gut. And that's interesting, that it can prevent the overgrowth of the negative bacteria. And so this is fascinating to me, that there is this intelligence, again, I use that word carefully, guys, evolutionary consistency, this evolutionary history for us that, look, we are evolved from chimps and bonobos. Those animals eat ripe fruit. They also eat meat, very clearly. And we're not necessarily gorillas eating 40 to 60 pounds of leaves a day with a huge commodious colon and fermenting those. We're not these people anymore. We're small colons, larger small intestines, which is meant to absorb nutrients higher up in our digestion. But yeah, this idea that like feeding the wrong types of fiber could be harmful is very interesting to me. And then we get to the idea of like resistant starch, which I think is probably a horrible idea. I mean, a lot of resistant starch is in things like unripe fruit. People are recommending, eat a green banana, eat a green mango, which makes zero sense evolutionarily. Or people are eating like potato fiber as resistant starch. And whenever I did this, it just made me fart like crazy and not feel good. It's like, what do you think about resistant starch?
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea to be eating things that are, especially starch that's resistant to our digestion. It's one thing to consume an indigestible fiber like cellulose, but starch, we're supposed to be breaking down our starch. If you're consuming starch and it's not being broken down, that's definitely going to cause issues. And that's why we don't want to eat green bananas, as you said. And if so, definitely cook them to help break down the starch, you know, if it's plantains or something. But yeah, I would go for the ripest available for sure. And just circling back, I don't necessarily think you were wrong as far as the polyphenols go. I think that you're right in that they're toxic if they're absorbed in large amounts. But the interesting thing about polyphenols is they aren't well absorbed at all.
That's
most of them, you know, barely absorbed, a couple of percent get absorbed. And instead, they head over to the large intestine where they are toxic to certain organisms. It's just certain bacteria that happen to be pretty harmful to us. So I don't think we want to be consuming high dose polyphenol supplements that get well absorbed. And we definitely don't want to be having the black pepper with them to increase their absorption. The whole point is they're not supposed to be well absorbed, and we want to get them in the amounts that they are in food, unless we're using them as a medicinal way to clear out bacteria or to clear out an overgrowth or infection or something. But yeah, I think we want to be consuming them in those very small amounts from the fruits and, you know, the cooked roots potentially. And I do think, again, as a caveat, when it comes to the like leafy vegetables or herbs, I do think cooked, you know, is okay, but these should be a supplement on the plate, a small part that maybe has some extra antimicrobial effects, but these aren't food, so to speak. And I'd certainly wouldn't be favoring them. I think that if we're going to include them in the diet, they should be a pretty minor part. So, and the other thing you mentioned that I think was really important to highlight is we have a small colon and a big small intestine, suggesting that we are not fermentative. We're not supposed to be consuming huge amounts of these really fibrous foods and fermenting them like the gorillas. And when you look across the different species of apes, the ones that have larger small intestines and consume more fruit tend to be more intelligent. And this is based on what's called the expensive tissue hypothesis, which suggests that if we have to waste a ton of energy, in the same way we talked about this with the PUFA, if we have to waste a ton of energy on digesting and fermenting, then we're not going to have enough energy for higher level functions like our brain. And we see this play out in the different ape species. So yeah, I think all of those things come together to paint a really clear picture. And that picture also, you know, coming back to your question, would not include a lot of resistant starch.
Great. Now, I love that you mentioned black pepper, because I was thinking about that as you were talking. And this is a story that I've told over and over, but it's difficult for me to communicate clearly. Curcumin, turmeric. So turmeric is a root, right? Contains an active ingredient called curcumin, which is a polyphenolic compound. As you said, humans don't absorb much curcumin. If you eat turmeric root, which is a root, it's going to have some defense chemicals. You don't absorb much curcumin. It may actually affect the gut flora in a positive way. But if you add black pepper, which is a seed, which contains compounds like piperine and other toxic compounds called safrole, but specifically piperine inhibits an enzyme in the liver called UDP glucuronosyl transferase, right? Long name. It's part of our detoxification systems. And when you inhibit that enzyme with piperine and pepper, you now absorb 1,000 to 2,000 times more of the curcumin, which is not what your body wants at all. And yet people are doing liposomal curcumin. They're trying to just hack their way to absorbing large amounts of polyphenols that your body does not want. And it detoxifies them. They're toxins. Now, this idea that they could groom the human gut is fascinating, but don't mix it with black pepper. And again, there are other negative things with black pepper. So UDP glucuronosyl transferase is part of a detoxification system in the liver that is probably going to detoxify many polyphenols. And I think curcumin is not the only one that is going to be increased with black pepper. So this is why I'm not a fan of pepper. And I don't know if I probably should talk more about this on social media. I put salt on my food, but I never use pepper. And I will not eat food with pepper. If I go to a restaurant that has pepper, I'm scraping it off. I'm that guy. I know you guys all thought that I was that guy. You're right. I am that guy at the restaurant. This is why I can't eat barbecue in Austin, Texas, because it's covered in pepper and I scrape it off. Or, you know, I went to barbecue with George St. Pierre when he was there. We were working with Heart and Soil. He collaborates with us at Heart and Soil, and I'm scraping the barbecue pepper off. Like, I do not eat pepper, and my gut doesn't feel as good if I even get a little bit in my food. I can taste it. So pepper is a seed. It's not healthy for humans, and that's why it's damaging to the gut in multiple ways. But yeah, resistant starch, not a good thing. You don't want to increase LPS in your body. Now, you know, it's funny. I was texting one of our mutual friends about this. I'm bummed that there is no good clinical test for circulating lipopolysaccharide. if there were a way to test this, I think we would have a very powerful metric. There's an anti-LPS antibody that I talked about with Georgi Dinkov, but it's just a research metric. I can never get it because I wanted to track it. I wanted to track my anti-LPS antibody in the body. I would love to experiment with different foods, add potato to my diet or add squash to my diet or add just do fruit and honey or add mango and see, does it change this LPS? You know, like how do I feel? That would be interesting to me, but there's no real way for people to measure endotoxin in the body. It's just clinical symptoms, right? Which is probably all we really need at this point.
Yeah. So the good news there is typically, I think we can identify it pretty clearly if a simple test, have some fruit juice versus have the whole fruit, you know, versus having the whole fruit with the fiber and see how you feel. Are you generally dealing with bloating and gas when you consume things that would be potentially fermented? Do you have brain fog? Does it decrease your energy? Those are pretty clear signs normally. And yeah, it would be great to have the lab test to corroborate that. But, you know, I think for right now, that's what we have to go with.
Yeah. So that's a good intro to gut. The gut is a very deep rabbit hole that we'll have to go on down more in a separate episode if we can. But I think high level, we've talked about fruit juice, honey, maple syrup. These are going to be the easiest to digest. You know, I think if people want to experiment with some roots, do so carefully, but it's possible. It's kind of the gray area for me too with an animal-based diet. Maybe white rice, though that I think that can be more problematic for people. But beyond that, I think that the sources of carbohydrates are tricky. And I do think that if people want to include starches in their diet, remember that there are starches like squash or pumpkin, which are actually fruits. And, you know, whenever I've experimented with starches, I always use a pressure cooker. I'm going to try and cook it as much as I possibly can. Just cook the crap out of it. Any other carbohydrate recommendations for people that are easily digestible?
Yeah. So really lean into whole fruit, dried fruit, fruit juices, frozen fruit, depending on what your availability of fresh fruit is. Those things can be really helpful. As far as root vegetables go, if someone is going to eat potatoes or sweet potatoes, which again, gray area, depending on the individual, I would say at the very least, definitely remove the skins where most of the or high concentrations of the anti-nutrients are going to be held and make sure they're very well cooked and consumed with a good amount of saturated fat. Anytime we're consuming any starch, that's really important. Again, talking about maybe one other aspect of the gut on the fat side is these saturated fats have really great antimicrobial effects. So consuming it alongside the starch will help to prevent bacteria from consuming them and also will stimulate the production and release of bile, which is also our main antibiotic that's meant to keep the small intestine clear of bacteria. So I would definitely be doing that if we are consuming those forms of carbohydrates. And I would echo, you know, the whole squash family, including pumpkin and zucchini and things like that as good sources as well. And then honey, maple syrup, those kinds of things.
If you guys are not aware, there's a squash that I love. It's called kabocha squash. It looks like a green pumpkin. I imagine this time of year in the United States, it's prevalent, but put that in the oven or cut it up, put it in a pressure cooker. It's delicious. And I'll tell you guys, like pressure cooked squash with butter, all of the starches taste better with butter. You know, the majority of the starches I get now are fruit starches, quote unquote. So kabocha squash, things like that. But I mean, this is pumpkin season, guys. So instead of your pumpkin spice latte, just get some pumpkin or, you know, get some spaghetti squash or some, you know, butternut squash with butter and you'll be doing yourself a favor. But I love that you mentioned that about the saturated fats being antimicrobial and helping with bile secretion, which is critical for digestion. Let's talk about carbohydrates as we wrap up the podcast here, and we'll have to do a part two. Let's go back to the energy model, the bioenergetic perspective, and talk about how and why carbohydrates are so important to really run your motor in the best way possible. And then we can talk about sources and, you know, the difference between carbohydrates and fat. If we choose to run on fat versus choosing to run on carbohydrates, how that affects the quote unquote engine.
Definitely. So I know you've talked about this as well in terms of what we're signaling to our bodies. Are we in a state of abundance, or instead, are we in a state of stress, starvation, famine, degeneration? And fat, or I should say carb availability, is one of the main determinants here. So one of the best ways that we can signal starvation is by cutting out carbohydrates, if we don't want to actually just fast, is we simply cut them out and it mimics the starvation state. That's because the starvation state is one where we're relying on our best store of fuel, which is our fat stores. We can store way more fuel as fat than we can as carbohydrate. That's because carbohydrate, we have to store it with a bunch of water. So if we were trying to store all this carbohydrate as our long-term storage, it wouldn't work very well. But instead, we can store fat very easily. And so when we don't have food coming in, we rely on our fat stores. But when we're in that state, there's a number of hormonal shifts that happen. You know, the stress hormones get upregulated, glucagon, adrenaline, cortisol. The thyroid hormones get downregulated in terms of production and conversion, in addition to the reproductive hormones getting downregulated. These are all totally beneficial adaptive responses to a state of starvation because they help us to conserve energy and survive for as long as possible. So there's a couple of key things that help signal that state. And one of the main ones is the lack of carbohydrates and the burning of fat. And that's because we need to have signals for the state, or it makes sense to help tell us to conserve energy. And this is a state, as we started off with, that we don't want to be mimicking. We want to be creating the opposite of the state. So when we zoom into what's going on in the mitochondria, we see this play out. That's where most of this starts, which essentially when we, and we'll dig into the details, but when we oxidize carbohydrates as a fuel instead of fat, we produce much more ATP relative to reactive oxygen species. We maintain a much higher NAD-10-ADH ratio, and this allows things to run more efficiently and produce more ATP. This is why our brains can use carbohydrates for a fuel, but they can't use fat as a fuel. There's too much oxidative stress, and our brains are really sensitive to that. They can use ketones, but that's separate, and we can come back to it. But essentially, because of this difference in effect in terms of the burning of these two different fuels, it provides a signal to slow down our rate of respiration, to slow down our metabolism. And so the way that this happens starts in the difference between fat and carb burning, which is glycolysis versus beta oxidation, where with glycolysis, we're producing primarily or only NADH as the electron carrier. And with beta oxidation from fat, we're producing equal amounts of FADH2 and NADH. When we take those over to the electron transport chain, they both drop their electrons off at different complexes, the NADH at complex 1 and the FADH2 at complex 2. And because of the difference between glycolysis and beta oxidation, with fat burning, we have way more FADH2 relative to NADH compared to carbohydrates, where we still have some FADH2, but we're talking like the ratio is a 250% difference. There's a 250% higher ratio of FADH2 to NADH from fat burning with an average, you know, like 16 chain fat compared to glucose. At the electron transport chain, there's competition between complex 1 and complex 2 for the electron acceptor, which is ubiquinone. And because of this, when we have a lot of electrons being dropped off at both complexes, things get partially stuck up. Essentially, if we're dropping off a lot more electrons at complex 2, we can't drop off electrons as quickly at complex 1, and they can't be picked up by ubiquinone because there's this competition for the electron acceptor. And as an effect of this, we can't drop off as many electrons from NADH at complex 1, and that NADH level builds up. At the same time, we produce more reactive oxygen species at complex 1 because they aren't, you know, we're not dropping the electrons off to ubiquinone. So we end up with a higher reactive oxygen species and a buildup of NADH relative to NAD because the NADH isn't able to drop off the electron and produce NADH or NAD+. And when we then go back to the Krebs cycle or TCA cycle, this is going to slow down some key enzymes in that cycle that slow down the rate that at which that cycle happens. There's three different enzymes that rely on NAD to function. And so when we have lower levels of NAD relative to NADH, it slows those down. So one of the main ones here is going to be isocitrate dehydrogenase. And that is going to then lead to a backup there and a buildup of citrate. That has a number of different effects. So the citrate on its own can then directly block glycolysis. It inhibits phosphofructokinase, which is the rate-limiting enzyme of glycolysis. But then it also leads to a buildup of acetyl-CoA. And so with the buildup of acetyl-CoA and the high NADH-10AD ratio, this then slows down pyruvate dehydrogenase, which further slows the entrance of glucose to pyruvate into the Krebs cycle. Now, because this is happening, essentially this is the, and there's a couple other smaller mechanisms going on, but this is a long-winded way of saying when we are using fat as our fuel source, this puts the brakes on our metabolic rate. It puts the brakes on at the electron transport chain with a lot of reactive oxygen species production, which if we produce enough of those, it'll totally stop our ATP production by inducing uncoupling. And it also slows down the Krebs cycle activity. Now, this is totally adaptive, right? If we zoom back out and remember why, you know, the larger context here, when we're burning fat, we want to conserve energy, conserve fuel. We want to turn our metabolic rate down. We aren't going to be favoring reproduction. We aren't going to be favoring a high metabolic state. We aren't going to be favoring strong cognitive function, a good immune system. We're going to be trying to survive because this is what is mimicking the starvation state. So essentially what we've gotten to here is that using fat as that fuel there instead of carbohydrate in the mitochondria leads to slower respiration and less ATP production. And that is not ideal when it comes to health.
And so it's back to abundance versus scarcity. You know, that carbohydrates are a signal of abundance for humans. And we see that at a bioenergetic level in the mitochondria, complex one, complex two, competition for ubiquinone, which is coenzyme Q10, there's reverse electron transport, reductive stress, oxygen species, creating this whole backup in the chain, you know, citrate, also citrate dehydrogenase. It's just not what we want to be doing. Now, did we do it at certain times in our evolution? Yes, we can argue about how much we did it. But I think it's very clear that if we want to give our body a signal of abundance and the biochemical mechanistic correlates are beautifully laid out by you, we want to eat carbohydrates. And, you know, I think there's, maybe we can talk about fructose for a moment, but I mean, we talked about starches. So hopefully people are not as fearful of glucose as they are of fructose. I don't think there's any reason to be fearful of fructose, but, you know, starches are glucose polymers, whether it's amylose or amylopectin. And so you can get your carbohydrates as pure glucose polymers if you want, or low fructose things. But, you know, what we're recommending also is honey, maple syrup, and fruits. So let's just touch on fructose for a moment and talk about why this is maybe misinterpreted or fear-mongered or just misconstrued as a negative thing.
Yeah, so fructose is looked at as the poison, as the one that is wreaking havoc and responsible for all of the degenerative disease in the West and in the States, which I think we would rather say polyunsaturated fats are a much better culprit. The main reason for this comes down to this idea that fructose, we're going to absorb it, it's going to go straight to the liver, and it's just going to become fat, and it's going to drive inflammation pathways. And that does happen when we're looking at rats that are fed pure fructose and high PUFA diets and are not given antibiotics. And all of those things are key. And the reason for that is a fewfold. So essentially, the liver doesn't just convert fructose to fat. There's a bunch of different things that it can do with fructose. It converts it to glucose or lactate and sends it out for the rest of the body to use. It'll store it as glycogen. It'll oxidate it or oxidize it to produce ATP. And then if all of its needs for fructose are satisfied, then it will convert some amount to fat, which will then be released or used later, whatever it is. Now, a lot of the research that's typically being used to suggest that fructose is just going to be converted straight to fat and produce all this inflammation. As I was saying, normally it's done in rats. And as a starting place, rat livers are very different from human livers in their capacity for fructose utilization. And part of this is because our livers are storage organ for carbohydrate for our brain. And so we need a really effective liver to be able to store a lot of glycogen because we've got big brains relative to other animals. Rats don't. And so they don't need very highly capable livers to be able to handle a lot of fructose. So that's part one. But the second part, and this is one of the biggest and clearest ones, is that in most of this research, nearly all of it, they're feeding pure fructose. And not only in rats, but also in humans, we don't absorb pure fructose very well. It shares a receptor for absorption with glucose. And everywhere that you find fructose in nature, in any food that you're going to consume, even not nature, even the high fructose corn syrup soda, it is paired with glucose. When you provide a fructose sweetened beverage or pure fructose in some other way, we have a lot of trouble absorbing it. It goes down to the colon, feeds bacteria that produce a lot of endotoxin, and that then causes massive issues at the liver. That alone has been shown to cause fatty liver disease and all sorts of issues there. And when you just provide antibiotics and still feed the pure fructose, you still feed it in a way that we're never going to see it in nature or just in life, and you feed this to rats, they will not get fatty liver disease from the fructose just because there's antibiotics killing off the bacteria and preventing the endotoxin production. So that is an absolutely huge, huge confounding variable in that sort of research. And there are others as well. Polyunsaturated fats are a big one. And you can see that if they just, there's studies where they'll just block lipoxygenase, just the LOX enzyme. And that is going to convert the omega-6s to various eicosanoids that increase inflammation. Just by blocking that, they will prevent the increase in fat production from fructose. And this is, again, in rats. So if you fed a rat a low PUFA diet, even with pure fructose, you still would be unlikely to cause fat production and inflammation of the liver. So there's these sorts of, this is the sort of research that's behind the idea that we shouldn't be consuming fructose. And this is why it doesn't actually play out in reality. And when you look at the studies trying to create this effect in humans, if it's any sort of real food or fructose with glucose, it totally fails because our livers do an incredible job of handling massive amounts of fructose, storing it as glycogen, releasing it as glucose, oxidizing it. And even massive boluses of pure fructose in humans are often, you know, pretty much okay. But once you start feeding, you know, 35% calorie surpluses from fructose sweetened beverages in humans who are maybe, you know, diabetic or not allowed to exercise, you can start to see some issues. But again, this is, no one's advocating for that. And that has really nothing to do with the fructose itself.
Have you ever seen a study showing that maple syrup, honey, or fruit is bad for humans? Because I haven't.
No, I haven't either.
Like a whole food. And, you know, I used to not think maple syrup was good because it's heated. But then I've only really seen studies in animal models, and maple syrup is actually not bad for animals as far as I can tell. But certainly in humans, there's studies with honey improving endothelial function, actually lowering fasting glucose in diabetics. And there's so many studies with fruit and fruit juice, not just the fiber, but fiberless fruit juice, whether it's grape juice, whether it's pomegranate juice, whether it's orange juice, improving endothelial function, decreasing oxidative stress, decreasing oxidized LDL, all kinds of metrics that improve with these things. And this is what I talked about. You know, I had Anthony Chafee on my show, such a good dude. And part of, you know, the carnivore community and kind of anti-fruit and anti-fructose. But we were able to really, I think, come to some agreement there and some understanding. Like, hey, look, there's no evidence that fruit is harmful for humans. So don't fear fructose from those things. Honey, maple syrup, fruit juice are not the same as high fructose corn syrup. This is something I talked about with Georgie when he was on the podcast. He's been on three times, guys. That there are studies in mice and rats, interestingly, that show high fructose corn syrup is very different than other forms of carbohydrates. There's some hidden carbohydrate in there or something that is mucking up physiology with high fructose corn syrup, whether it's heavy metals or something in the processing. High fructose corn syrup is a very processed food. It's an ultra processed form of sugar, and it should not be conflated with the naturally occurring sucrose or, you know, this disaccharide of fructose and glucose in fruit, honey, things like this. And as you point out, humans will never consume fructose without glucose. So any study that's doing that is just kind of an inaccurate model of what we're doing here. So look, if you're still afraid of fructose, fine, get your carbohydrates from glucose. We talked about starches and, you know, whether you want to get squash or zucchini or others, it's possible. But I think that there are a lot of benefits to fruit and fruit juice, whether it's polyphenols like naringenin in orange juice. Again, lots of benefits from the fruit. It's delicious and it's evolutionarily what we were doing as humans for sure, along with honey. I'll tell you, when we found ripe berries or we found honey with the Hadza, they went off and just ate it all. So they didn't fear it. They weren't like, hey, let me get my CGM out and check my blood sugar here. They don't worry about that kind of stuff. And they're very metabolically healthy. So man, we've covered a lot. I just want to wrap up with like, what have you eaten today? So let's give people actionable ideas. I mean, if you guys are listening to this, you know what I think of an animal-based diet. I show what I eat all the time. It's meat, it's organs, either fresh or desiccated, like hardened soil supplements. It's fruit, it's honey, it's raw dairy. And so that's what I eat, but I'm curious what you eat, Jay, and how you structure it. Again, let's give people like an idea of like, okay, how would you translate these concepts into actionable food in the day?
Sure. Yeah. And for, you know, a caveat I always like to give is my diet has changed a lot as I move to different places, live in different places, or just as I experiment with different things. And so, yeah, this is great for providing ideas. I wouldn't say like, this is the golden template or anything like that. You know, take all of it with a grain of salt and consider your own individuality and experimentation. But yeah, so breakfast today, I had a smoothie with fruit and a bit of maple syrup in it. And I had a hash that was some potatoes and it was actually chicken breast, although we have local, very well pastured chicken here that's actually fully pastured. And a couple of eggs on top of that. And then I had coffee with about a cup of of local A2 milk in it and some sugar. So that was breakfast. And then so far lunch was, I actually had some shrimp. It was, I don't know what else, you know, cooked in butter and some things like that. Had a couple pieces of fruit alongside it. So right now, oranges and tangerines and watermelon and things like that are in season here. We don't have, the tropical fruit is not in season at the moment. So, you know, sometimes I would be eating more rambutans and mangoes and those kinds of things. But so there's a couple of oranges, and we actually have some parsnip chips here cooked in palm oil. So I had some of those, and that was pretty much, I think, lunch. And and I had some dried mango as well. So that was what lunch was. And then I did have like a snack, you know, a little bit later on that was pretty similar. It was actually a few chicken wings, and I don't normally eat this much chicken, but today was a chicken day.
Chicken day.
Again, pastured chicken. And the wings, you know, have more gelatin in them and everything from the skin. You know, and normally I'll have more like beef and lamb here, but anyway, so some chicken wings, some more dried fruit and fresh fruit alongside that.
How many calories do you think you eat in a day, Jay?
Typically it's between 3,500 and 4,000.
Right. And you're how tall and how much do you weigh?
So I'm 6'2 and weigh like 182 to 185.
What do you think your body fat is? Any idea?
It's right around 10%. I'd like to go get it checked for sure, but
yeah. I just had mine checked with a DEXA. We talked about that on Instagram. Mine's 10.5. I'm 165 pounds. I'm 5'9". And I probably eat about 3,500 calories a day. So this is just to illustrate to you guys that both Jay and I believe that we have healthy thyroid function. We are humans. We are not over-exercising. People always think that I'm just working out 6 hours a day, which I'm not. I'm surfing, which I love. And that is certainly some caloric load on my body. But if any of you guys have ever surfed, you know that the majority of time when you're surfing, you're sitting in the ocean talking to your friends and waiting for waves. And then sometimes a wave comes and you paddle for it like crazy. But surfing is not 2 hours of running. I'm not running a marathon every day by any stretch of the imagination. And I don't actually lift many weights anymore. I might do some pull-ups. I might do some walking. I skate. I have a skate ramp in my house that I built because I love surf. And so I'm not crazy with my activity. I probably have more than the average human, but I'm not working out 6 hours a day. And I think I'm probably 3,500 to 4,000 calories a day. This is just to illustrate the idea that, look, calories in, calories out is overly simplified. You know, if I go to Chronometer, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, and I've shown my diet, Chronometer says I'm supposed to be eating something like 1,900 calories a day. It's like, that's about half of what I eat in a day, right? And I'm certainly not burning 1,900 calories a day in my activity. No way am I burning 1,900 calories. The ocean here is 86 degrees. There's no thermal stress in Costa Rica. I'm not cold plunging much anymore. So like there's no way. Like these estimates of caloric load and BMR are just, they're wonky. They're really wonky. And I think it's just a testament to the idea that if your engine works well, if your mitochondria work well, if your thyroid works well, you can put a lot of fuel in your body and your body will convert its energy and it will do so happily. It will get a signal of abundance. It will give you testosterone. It will give you libido. It will give you children. It will give you fertility. And if you're a woman, it will give you estrogen. And it'll give you, again, libido as a woman, it'll give you strength and it'll give you resilience. It'll give you good sleep and healthy mood. And that's what I think this energetic perspective is all about. So that's incredible. And how much activity are you doing, Jay?
Not much these days. I have maybe two structured workouts a week. One will be weightlifting. The other is some form of MMA or kickboxing. And other than that, just, you know, walking the dog and maybe running around a little bit in the yard with her. But really, really not much. I'd like for it to be more, but things are busy sometimes. But if it is, if it's any more, then yeah, definitely into that 4,000 calorie range. And in the past, it's been up there for sure.
So. You got to start surfing, bro. And you live in Ecuador.
Definitely. I do, although I'm way up in the mountains. So it'd be pretty far to get
to. Not a lot of surfing there. Well, we'll build you a skate ramp or something. Where can people find your work, more of what you're doing?
Yeah, definitely. So my website is jfeldmanwellness.com. And for people who are looking for, you know, a simple guide as a starting place when it comes to food choices and whatnot, I have what's called the Energy Balance Food Guide. It's a one-page infographic, organizes foods based on, firstly, a spectrum of how well it's going to help you produce energy, but also there's a separate spectrum in terms of your digestive capacity, which is really helpful for being able to know what to change if you're dealing with some digestive issues. So listeners can find that at jfeldmanwellness.com/guide. And then, as you mentioned, I have a podcast called the Energy Balance Podcast.
Yeah. And I would recommend people start at episode one and just listen, even, I mean, listen to as many as you want, but even just the first couple will give you an in-depth perspective on all the stuff we're talking about, and we'll get you back on for another episode. But thank you so much, brother. And I appreciate you. Thanks for doing this work in the world. I think it's really helping a lot of people.
Yeah, Paul, thanks so much for having me. It was fun.